This is a matter of interest in the light of the Mesopotamian traditions of the Apkalus, explored in Chapter 8, and it seems that something more than coincidence is involved. The reader will recall that the Apkalus were often depicted as hybrid creatures, part bird of prey, part human in appearance. Similarly, the seven sages of the Edfu texts are described as primeval deities who were capable of assuming the form of falcons and resembling falcons. Also, exactly like the antediluvian Apkalus, the seven sages of the Edfu texts, who are not mentioned elsewhere in ancient Egyptian inscriptions, were the magicians amongst the gods. They were the seers who could foretell the future, and they could endue with power the substances of the earth, a process of creation by the word of the creators that Raymond notes has no equivalent. They were, in addition, believed to have the ability to magnify things, and thus to provide magical protection. On this point, the best sense Raymond is able to make of what she describes as an unusually obscure text is that the protection was constituted by means of symbols. The magical power of protecting was conferred by a giving of names. The Apkalus mingled their magic with practical skills, such as laying the foundations of cities and temples. Similarly, the seven sages of the Edfu texts also had their practical architectural side, and many passages testify to their involvement in the setting out and construction of buildings and in the laying of foundations. Moreover, the Egyptians believed that the ground plans of the historical temples were established according to what the sages of the primeval age revealed to Thoth. This hint of a special connection between the sages and Thoth is, of course, a further parallel, for as we've seen, the Apkalus were linked to Enki, the Mesopotamian god of wisdom. In the Mesopotamian inscriptions, however, Enki is clearly superior to the sages. Indeed, he is their maker. But in the Edfu texts, strangely, it appears that the knowledge of the sages is regarded as superior to that of the wisdom god Thoth. Indeed, it was the tradition at Edfu that the original records and archives from which the texts were extracted were nothing less than the words of the sages, given as dictation to Thoth, who had then consigned them to writing. The texts further disclose that the sages of the mythical age were believed to be the only divine beings who knew how the temples and sacred places were created, and were themselves the very creators of knowledge, which thereafter could only be passed on, but not invented anew. This finds parallels in the Mesopotamian notion that since the time of the antediluvian Apkalus, nothing new had been invented, with the original revelation simply being retransmitted and unfolded in later epochs. Without laboring the point further, therefore, it seems to me that the idea conveyed so strongly in the cuneiform inscriptions of ancient Mesopotamia, of a project to recover and re-promulgate antediluvian knowledge after a global cataclysm, is rather exactly the same project that is set out in the Edfu building texts, which in turn bear uncanny and troubling resemblances to Plato's report of the destroyed Ice Age civilization of Atlantis. More than that, the Edfu texts invite us to consider the possibility that the survivors of the lost civilization, thought of as gods but manifestly human, albeit with mysterious powers, set about wandering the world after the flood. By happenstance, it was only hunter-gatherer populations, the peoples of the mountains and the deserts, the unlettered and the uncultured, as Plato so eloquently put it in his Timaeus, who had been spared the scourge of the deluge. But the civilizers entertained the desperate hope, if their mission would succeed, that mankind might not have to begin again like children, in complete ignorance of what happened in early times. The evidence of the Mesopotamian inscriptions, and of Göbekli Tepe, to which we will return, is that the mountain lands of ancient Armenia and eastern Turkey were amongst the primal wildernesses to which the civilizers made their way after the flood. But the testimony of Edfu is that they also came to the Nile flowing in its fertile valley through the deserts of Egypt. Moreover, the building texts say very clearly which part of Egypt they came to first. And it was not Edfu, as we'll see in the next chapter. Chapter 10 Monastery of the Seven Sages. In his Timaeus, we've seen how Plato speaks of events described in ancient Egyptian temple records that took place 9,000 years before the time of Solon, in other words, in 9,600 BC. Nor is the Timaeus the only place where Plato alludes to such vast antiquity. In his Laws, for example, he says of the ancient Egyptians, "If you examine their art on the spot, you will find that 10,000 years ago, and I'm not speaking loosely, I mean literally 10,000, paintings and reliefs were produced that are no better and no worse than those of today." It's interesting how the Greek philosopher makes a point of this 10,000 years ago, emphasizing that he's not speaking loosely, that he really means it. But we live supposedly in a more scientific age with the benefit of objective dating techniques, so what are we to make of such a chronology? Plato was born around 428 BC, so his reference to 10,000 years ago translates to around 10,400 BC in our calendar, within a whisker of the date of 10,450 BC that I proposed in Fingerprints of the Gods for the remote epoch, Zeptepi, the first time when the ancient Egyptians believed that the gods walked the earth and the civilization of the Nile Valley had its true beginnings. The date, based on findings that arose from research underlying the Orion mystery, my friend Robert Boval's groundbreaking 1994 study of the astronomical aspects of the world-famous pyramids of Giza in Egypt, was developed further by the two of us in 1996 in our co-authored book, Keeper of Genesis, titled The Message of the Sphinx in the US. In brief, the date arises from the extraordinarily precise layout of the principal monuments of the Giza Plateau, and the relationship of these monuments to certain stars in the sky. For full details, I refer the reader to Fingerprints of the Gods and to Keeper of Genesis, where this issue is explored in depth. But the heart of the matter lies in the fact that the positions of the stars in the sky are not fixed and finite, but change very gradually over a great cycle, known to astronomers as the precessional cycle, that unfolds in a period of 25,920 years. The cycle is the result of a motion of the Earth itself, a slow, circular wobble of the planet's axis of rotation, unfolding at the rate of 1 degree every 72 years. Since the Earth is the viewing platform from which we observe the stars, these changes in orientation inevitably affect the positions and rising times of all stars as viewed from Earth. Our pole star, for example, around which the remainder of the heavens appear to revolve, is simply the star at which the Earth's extended axis, passing through the geographical North Pole, points most directly. Presently, it is Polaris, Alpha Ursae Minoris, in the constellation of the Little Bear. But the effect of precession is to change the pole star over very long periods of time. Thus, around 3000 BC, just before the start of the Pyramid Age in Egypt, the pole star was Thuban, Alpha Draconis in the constellation of Draco. At the time of the Greeks, it was Beta Ursae Minoris. In AD 14,000, it will be Vega. Sometimes, in this long cyclical journey, the extended north pole of the Earth will point at empty space, and then there will be no useful pole star. The most dramatic, and indeed beautiful and aesthetically pleasing effects of precession, however, are those observed at the horizon on the March equinox, when night and day are of equal length, and when the sun rises perfectly due east, against the background of the 12 constellations of the zodiac. The rate of change is the same as at the pole, in other words, just 1 degree every 72 years, so it cannot easily be observed, let alone measured, in a single human lifetime. But if yours is a culture that keeps careful records over very long periods, it will be noted that the zodiacal constellation that houses the sun on that special day, marking the beginning of spring in the northern hemisphere, does indeed very slowly shift along the horizon until eventually the next constellation takes its place. Broadly speaking, the sun spends 2,160 years in each house of the zodiac, 30 degrees by 72 years, and since there are 12 zodiacal houses, the result is that the great year, the full precessional cycle, unfolds in 12 times 2,160 years, in other words, 25,920 years, at which point the cycle is back at its starting point and a new great year begins. In the Sun's annual path through the zodiac, spending approximately 1 month in each sign, as all of us who check our horoscopes are aware, Aquarius is followed by Pisces, which in turn is followed by Aries, which is followed by Taurus, then Gemini, then Cancer, then Leo, etc., etc. But the slow, majestic, precessional course of the Sun through the great year is a backwards motion that unfolds in exactly the opposite direction, thus Leo, Cancer, Gemini, Taurus, Aries, Pisces, Aquarius, with each month being 2,160 years in length. So, to give some specific examples, it is not an accident that the early Christians used the fish as their symbol, since the constellation of Pisces housed the sun on the spring equinox from the very beginning of the Christian era until today. Nor is the famous song wrong to state that we live in the dawning of the age of Aquarius, for the early 21st century does indeed stand in the astrological no man's land near the end of the age of Pisces and on the threshold of the new age of Aquarius. Going back before the age of Pisces, we come to the age of Aries, 2330 BC to 170 BC, when, in ancient Egypt, rams were the dominant symbolic motif, for example, the ram-headed sphinxes at the Temple of Karnak in Luxor, and before that to the age of Taurus, 4490 BC to 2330 BC, when the cult of the Apis bull was initiated as early as the First Dynasty, or perhaps before. Different astrologers and astronomers might choose to move the constellation boundaries a few degrees, and thus a century or two, in one direction or another. But the general schema is well understood, and the dates given above stand as a good approximation to the facts. Moving back in time further, as it is easy to do with modern computer programs that simulate ancient skies, we come eventually to the age of Leo, when the constellation of Leo, the lion, housed the sun on the spring equinox. This astrological age spans the period between 10,970 BC and 8,810 BC, although again, depending on where one sets the constellation boundaries, the dates might be pushed back or forward by a couple of centuries. What is clear, however, even with a little boundary juggling, is that the age of Leo pretty much perfectly encloses the younger Dryas, 10,800 to 9,600 BC, something that I was unaware of when I wrote Fingerprints of the Gods. And it was, of course, also the age of Leo that I signaled in Fingerprints as the most likely candidate for the remote epoch that the ancient Egyptians called Zeptepi, the first time. Again, I refer readers to Fingerprints and to Keeper of Genesis and to my later book Heaven's Mirror for more detailed discussions of the astronomical facts and of the ideas behind them. The essence of the argument, however, is that there was an ancient, globally distributed doctrine, as above, so below, that set out quite deliberately to create monuments on the ground that copied the patterns of certain significant constellations in the sky. Moreover, since the positions of all stars change slowly but continuously as a result of the precession, it is possible to use particular configurations of astronomically aligned monuments to deduce the dates that they represent, in other words, the dates when the stars were last in the positions depicted by the monuments on the ground. The Giza Plateau contains the world's most striking array of astronomically aligned monuments, and for purposes of clarity, let me emphasize that these alignments have nothing to do with compass directions. The north indicated by a compass is magnetic north, which can vary by 10 degrees or more from true north, and wanders constantly because of magnetic changes in the Earth's core. True north is the geographical north pole of the Earth, in other words, the pivot of our planet's axis of rotation. From it, true south, east and west are derived. It is therefore significant that the gaze of the Great Sphinx is perfectly targeted on true east, while the three great pyramids are aligned with uncanny precision to true north and south. Indeed, the error in the case of the Great Pyramid is just 3/60ths of a single degree. What this tells us is that all these monuments were set out using astronomy, for it is not possible to achieve such precision by any other means. In other words, even if there were no additional astronomical characteristics present, we would have to say, on grounds of accuracy of alignment alone, that astronomers had been at work here. But in fact, there are many other astronomical characteristics, not only in the monuments themselves, but also in ancient Egyptian scriptures such as the pyramid texts. And for these, since I wish to avoid unnecessary repetition, I again refer the reader to my earlier books. The heart of the matter, however, involves two constellations: the constellation of Leo, rising due east above the sun at dawn on the spring equinox in the epoch of 10,500 BC, and the constellation of Orion, which the ancient Egyptians visualized as the celestial figure of the god Osiris, the deceased god-king who ruled over the afterlife kingdom known as the Duat. As we saw in Chapter 9, Osiris was also believed in some way to be the Ka, the double or spiritual essence of the pyramids of Giza. I will not vex the reader with lengthy substantiations of the assertions that follow, since they are fully backed up, referenced, and documented in my earlier books, but an uncanny sky-ground lock occurs at Giza in the epoch of 10,500 BC. I had opted for a date 50 years later, 10,450 BC, in fingerprints, but such minor details are not really significant, since the stellar changes are so slow, even within a single astrological age, that the same general configuration holds good for many centuries. Indeed, it's true to say that the Giza sky-ground lock stays in place throughout most, if not all, of the Younger Dryas, from 10,800 BC down to 9,600 BC. Effectively, therefore, the epoch of the first time, which I will continue for ease of reference to refer to as the epoch of 10,500 BC, is the epoch of the Younger Dryas, and while it was a time of freezing temperatures further north, particularly in North America and Northern Europe, indications are that the climate in Egypt would have been much more comfortable and conducive, and much wetter and more fertile than it is today. This is not to say that Egypt was entirely spared the cataclysms of the Younger Dryas. There were powerful and destructive Nile floods, as we shall see. But by comparison with many other parts of the world, it would have stood out as an inviting refuge. As above, so below. To return to the matter of the sky-ground lock at Giza in the epoch of 10,500 BC, let us consider first the lion-bodied, and very likely once lion-headed monument, oriented perfectly due east, that we call the Great Sphinx. It looks not only at the rising sun on the spring equinox, but also at the constellation that houses the sun on the equinox. Today, therefore, this monument gazes at the cusp between Pisces and Aquarius. At the time of the building of the Temple of Karnak, it gazed at the constellation of Aries. And in the Old Kingdom, when the Sphinx was supposedly built, it gazed at the constellation of Taurus the Bull, clearly not a perfect sky-ground match. Indeed, only in one epoch in the last 25,920 years has the lion-bodied Sphinx looked out at its own celestial counterpart, the constellation of Leo, in the pre-dawn on the spring equinox, and that was in the epoch of 10,500 BC. But there is more. In that same epoch, at the exact moment that the sun bisected the horizon due east, the three belt stars of the constellation of Orion lay due south on the meridian, and they did so in a pattern that very precisely matches the pattern of the three great pyramids on the ground, thus making sublime sense of the image of Osiris Orion as the Ka, or double of the pyramids. After Robert Bovall presented the Orion correlation to a global readership in his 1994 book The Orion Mystery, and after the further work I did on the subject in Fingerprints of the Gods and that Robert and I did together in Keeper of Genesis, the hypothesis came in for a great deal of criticism from the mainstream archaeoastronomer Ed Krupp of the Griffiths Observatory in Los Angeles. Krupp claimed that the correlation was upside down, an argument of some sophistry based on the apparent curvature of the sky, which means that the highest of the three stars of Orion's belt, matched in the Orion correlation by the southernmost of the three pyramids, is effectively the northernmost star. Refuting this, we were able to demonstrate that laying the pyramids out on the ground in the way that would satisfy Krupp might be technically correct in terms of modern astronomical conventions, but would not produce an immediately recognizable and visually pleasing similitude between what is seen in the sky and what is seen on the ground, if on the other hand one steers clear of 21st century astronomical conventions in which north is up and simply models on the ground rather as an artist or a sculptor would what would have been seen in the sky at dawn on the spring equinox in the epoch of 10,500 BC, then the result is indeed a very good match, as Robert Bovall has always claimed, between the three great pyramids and the three stars of Orion's belt. Moreover, as noted above, the particularly striking feature of this match is its lock with the Sphinx Leo. The point is worth re-emphasizing. Looking east in the pre-dawn, about an hour before sunrise on the morning of the spring equinox in the epoch of 10,500 BC, we see the constellation of Leo lying with its belly on the horizon, directly in line with the gaze of the Sphinx. There is an unmissable sky-ground correlation here, for the constellation of Leo in profile, as seen at this moment, does very closely resemble the profile of the Leonine Sphinx. The Earth turns, the stars and the sun rise, light floods the sky, and in due course, after about an hour, the solar disk bisects the horizon precisely due east, again exactly in line with the gaze of the Sphinx. At the precise moment it does so, the three stars of Orion's belt fall into place centered due south over the meridian. This is confirmed absolutely by modern astronomical software, and it would have been known absolutely by anyone with sophisticated knowledge of the motions of the heavens, should such a person have been present at Giza in the epoch of 10,500 BC. Indeed, one can almost feel the ponderous gears of the sky at work, like a huge clock. The hour hand is the Sphinx-Leo correlation, and the minute hand is the pyramid's Orion's belt correlation, and both work together to point unmistakably to the epoch of 10,500 BC. This is the epoch that I long ago suggested was the mysterious ancient Egyptian first time, but that I now understand was significant for the world-changing cataclysm of the Younger Dryas as well. Dating with stars. The use of combinations of stars in the sky and large-scale constructions on the ground to point symbolically to significant moments in history was a practice widely pursued in antiquity, as extensively documented in my 1998 book, Heaven's Mirror. Indeed, examples of such sky-ground mirroring, once they are properly understood, frequently shed new light on archaeological inquiries. For example, in 2014, an ancient mound in the Republic of Macedonia was identified as man-made by archaeoacoustic analysis. The mound's dimensions are 85 meters by 45 meters. It is very precisely oriented north-south, and at its summit, placed within an oval ditch, a giant earthwork has been identified by researchers from the University of Trieste as a representation of the constellation of Cassiopeia, as it would have appeared from the site at dawn on 21 July 356 BC, the birthday of the famed Macedonian ruler Alexander the Great. Cassiopeia lies directly to the north, the researchers conclude, and stands vertically above the geoglyph in the sky's zenith, forming a perfect picture of the sky on the earth. Nor are such sky-ground endeavors confined to the ancient world. A relatively recent example is the Hoover Dam in the United States. There, at the base of the towering Monument of Dedication, with its black diorite pedestals supporting two colossal and imposing winged figures, themselves reminiscent of Mesopotamian and ancient Egyptian deities, the sculptor, Oscar Hansen, created a spectacular terrazzo floor with an inbuilt star chart. Here's how the U.S. Department of the Interior's Bureau of Reclamation describes the artwork and its purpose. The chart preserves, for future generations, the date on which President Franklin D. Roosevelt dedicated Hoover Dam, September 30, 1935. In this celestial map, the bodies of the solar system are placed so exactly that those versed in astronomy could calculate the precession, progressively earlier occurrence of the pole star, for approximately the next 14,000 years. Conversely, future generations could look upon this monument and determine, if no other means were available, the exact date on which Hoover Dam was dedicated. Hansen, who explicitly compared the dam to the Great Pyramid as a monument to collective genius, exerting itself in community efforts around a common need or ideal, also incorporated the signs of the zodiac into his design. Such elements, he said, were all put there as clues and pointers, so that in remote ages to come, intelligent people would be able to discern the astronomical time of the dam's dedication. It so happens that the Hoover Dam and its monumental sculptures were completed in the same year, 1935, but it is of course possible to use symbolic architecture and astronomical alignments to make a permanent statement about significant moments in the past at any time. A parallel might be the great Gothic cathedrals of Europe, built in the 12th and 13th centuries of our era, but referring in every symbolic detail, and in the sacred astronomy built into their stones and stained glass, to much earlier periods, notably to the time of Christ and the time of the Old Testament patriarchs. From a purely astronomical point of view, what can be said about the huge effort and endeavor of the Giza monuments is that the ground plan of the pyramids and the Sphinx does speak clearly of the epoch of 10,500 BC. But as readers of my previous books will be aware, the monuments also include features such as the four narrow shafts angled up through the body of the Great Pyramid that target significant stars in the epoch of 2500 BC, when Egyptologists believe the pyramids were built. In other words, both epochs are symbolized, 2500 BC by the shafts and 10,500 BC by the ground plan. Long-lived cult of the sages. The hypothesis I derive from this is that Giza was one of several sites around the world, Göbekli Tepe was another, where survivors of a great prehistoric civilization that had been all but destroyed in the global cataclysm at the onset of the Younger Dryas chose to settle, and where their sages set in motion a long-term plan to bring about the resurrection of the former world of the gods, the recreation of the destroyed world. Perhaps they felt that their own civilization had made some terrible error, some ghastly mistake that had brought down the punishment of the universe upon them in the form of the Younger Dryas comet, and that it would therefore be impious or unwise to seek to refashion the destroyed world all at once and straight away. Indeed, perhaps it proved impossible for them to do so, though its climate would have been attractive at a time when much of the world was in the midst of a sudden deep freeze. The Nile Valley, like so many other places, did suffer cataclysmic events both at the beginning and at the end of the Younger Dryas. These events included episodes of extreme river floods, the so-called Wild Nile, that recurred several times in the epoch of 10,500 BC, with calmer and more predictable conditions not being restored until about 9,000 BC. Located on higher ground, well above the valley floor, there's no evidence to suggest that Giza itself was ever scoured by those floods, and it would therefore have been an obvious choice in Egypt for the survivors to have established a base and begun work on an architectural project, perhaps focused around certain natural features of the plateau itself. Amongst these, I would draw particular attention to the rocky hill, more than 30 feet high, an excellent contender for the great primeval mound described in the Edfu texts, as we shall see, that would much later be incorporated into the core of the Great Pyramid. I suggest that a shaft was cut down into this hill, and deep into the bedrock beneath it to create the rectangular cavity that is now nominated as the subterranean chamber, which can still only be accessed today through that same 300-foot-long shaft, now known as the descending corridor, that dives deeply into the bowels of the earth at an angle of 26 degrees. In my view, it is probably only one of several underground features that were created at that time, with others, far more extensive, still awaiting discovery. Likewise, these visitors to primeval Giza of the epoch of 10,500 BC would also have found a crest or ridge of rock. The technical term for such a feature is a yardang, protruding down slope that had perhaps already been sculpted by the prevailing winds into something resembling the head of a lion. It faced east and overlooked the Nile Valley, and it would in due course be extensively excavated and carved to form the Great Sphinx. It is likely that some substantial work was done in the epoch of 10,500 BC to free at least the front quarters of the core body of the Sphinx from its surrounding bedrock. But my view, unchanged since I wrote Fingerprints of the Gods, is that the majority of the work on this project, as on the pyramids themselves, was done later and finally completed in the epoch of 2,500 BC. When the original leonine head of the Sphinx, perhaps heavily eroded, was recarved into the disproportionately small human head that it still has today. My hypothesis then and now is that the same sacred cult, housed in something perhaps like a monastery, with a very small, even negligible archaeological footprint, let us call it the Monastery of the Seven Sages, was involved in both major phases of the work, and in everything that happened at Giza in between. As I wrote in 1995, this hypothesis resolves the anomaly of the missing 8,000 years between the two epochs by supposing the star shafts of the Great Pyramid to be merely the later work of the same long-lived cult that originally laid out the Giza ground plan in 10,450 BC. Naturally, the hypothesis also suggests that it was this same cult, towards the end of those 8,000 missing years, that provided the initiating spark for the sudden and fully formed emergence of the literate and accomplished historical civilization of dynastic Egypt. Dating with light. Since the publication of Fingerprints of the Gods, I've had many years to reflect on the mysteries of Giza. It remains my view that the role of the historical pharaohs of the Fourth Dynasty was to complete and finally fulfill a much more ancient plan, first brought to Egypt in the epoch of 10,500 BC. As noted above, however, the subterranean elements of the Giza Plateau and the earliest work on the Sphinx may actually date back to the epoch of 10,500 BC. By virtue of the distinctive weathering patterns on that monument's flanks and on sections of the trench that surrounds it, highlighted in the analysis of geology professor Robert Schock of Boston University, a proto-Sphinx does appear to have existed when heavy rains fell across Egypt at the end of the Ice Age, perhaps even as early as the Wild Nile period. I have long been convinced by the geological evidence that the Sphinx does in fact date back in some form to the epoch of 10,500 BC. But there's a grey area to do with events between 10,500 BC and 2,500 BC, and this concerns the megalithic temples of the plateau, particularly the Sphinx Temple, directly in front, in other words, to the east of the Sphinx itself, and the Valley Temple, which lies immediately southeast of the Sphinx, both of which are built for the most part of limestone blocks excavated from around the core body of the Sphinx, although in many cases the limestone blocks are surfaced with a veneer of granite. The orthodox archaeological dating of these structures, both of their limestone and of their granite elements, is to the Old Kingdom, specifically to the Fourth Dynasty, approximately 2613 BC to 2494 BC, in other words, to the epoch of 2500 BC. When I wrote Fingerprints of the Gods, however, I was open to the possibility that they might date back to the epoch of 10,500 BC. I remain so, but in the light of recent evidence, some careful consideration is required. This is the case because an advanced scientific technique known as surface luminescence dating, which measures light energy stored in stone, has been applied to these temples. This technique seems, on the face of things, to rule out rather conclusively any possibility that the temples were created in the form we see them now in the epoch of 10,500 BC. I say on the face of things, because there are certain problems with the new technique, which mean that any conclusions drawn from it must be carefully thought through. Most significantly, as the researchers themselves admit, surface luminescence dating relies upon the assumption that the sample being tested has not been exposed to sunlight since it was set into place in the building of which it is a part. Should there have been exposure to sunlight, even if just minutes in duration, as would happen, for example, if any later reworking of the sampled area had been undertaken without cover of a roof, then the latent luminescence is released, setting the signal to zero or near zero, and thus yielding a date that reflects the most recent reworking rather than the original date at which the building was constructed. The Giza surface luminescence dating study was conducted by nuclear physicist Professor Ioannis Liritsis and his colleague Asiminia Vafiadou, both of the Laboratory of Archaeometry at the University of the Aegean. They reported their results in detail in 2015 in the Journal of Cultural Heritage. Conclusive indications that at least some of the structures they sampled had indeed been reworked, with their latent luminescence zeroed and the clock set ticking again at the time of the reworking, are provided by sample number 4, Vali Temple limestone, and sample number 6, Sphinx Temple granite. The former yielded a very young surface luminescence date of 1050 BC, plus or minus 540 years, while the latter yielded a surface luminescence date of 1190 BC, plus or minus 340 years. These are, effectively, dates from ancient Egypt's New Kingdom, 18th dynasty and later, and we have firm archaeological and epigraphic evidence that both the Sphinx Temple and the Vali Temple were already very ancient by New Kingdom times. Since this is so, the other dates yielded by the study must also be regarded with caution, and certainly cannot be taken as firm evidence of the date of construction of the temples, particularly in the case of sample number 3, Vali Temple granite, and samples number 7 and 8, both Sphinx Temple granite. These yielded surface luminescence dates respectively of 3060 BC, plus or minus 470 years, 2740 BC, plus or minus 640 years, and 3100 BC, plus or minus 540 years. These dates are broadly compatible with the Old Kingdom, although with some reservations which we'll explore below. But they do not, under any circumstance, rule out a much more ancient date of construction for the limestone core masonry of the temples, since it has always been Robert Schoch's contention that the granite sheathing was added in the Old Kingdom to repair and restore the earlier, much earlier, Sphinx Age limestone temples. We are left, then, with only a single sample. Sample number 5, which was taken from the original limestone core masonry of the Sphinx Temple. It yielded a surface luminescence date of 2220 plus or minus 220 years, but really nothing very conclusive can be said about it or deduced from it, since its location does not rule out the possibility, as Schoch observed when I asked him to comment on these findings, that it may also have been exposed or reworked during repairs to the structure during the Old Kingdom. In summary, the new study does not provide any evidence to confirm beyond doubt that the original limestone megalithic elements of the Sphinx and Vali temples were built by the 4th dynasty pharaoh Khafre, as archaeologists maintain. On the contrary, the only thing the study seems to demonstrate for sure is that these temples were reworked during the New Kingdom. More alarming for the mainstream chronology, the surface luminescence dating raises the possibility that the granite sheathing on the temples, with the exception of sample number 6 with its New Kingdom date, was not added in the 4th dynasty at all, but many centuries earlier, indeed as early as 3380 BC at the extreme end of the dating range for sample number 7, as early as 3530 BC for sample number 3, and as early as 3640 BC for sample number 8. This potentially pushes what Robert Schoch has always regarded as restoration work on the Sphinx Temple, the adding of a granite veneer on top of much older and extensively eroded megalithic limestone blocks, far back into the pre-dynastic period, in other words, long before any large-scale construction is supposed to have been undertaken in Egypt. And needless to say, if these temples were in need of such radical restoration in the pre-dynastic period, then their core masonry is likely to be very ancient indeed, perhaps even going back as far as the epoch of 10,500 BC. So much then for the Sphinx Temple and the Valley Temple. But what of the enigmatic pyramids that loom over them? The researchers were not able to study the second pyramid at Giza, conventionally attributed, like the Sphinx and its temples, to Khafre. Nor did they investigate the Great Pyramid, attributed to Khufu. But they did test a single sample from the smallest of the three pyramids, which Egyptology attributes to Menkaure, the pharaoh who succeeded Khafre to the throne. Taken from the granite facing stones of the pyramid and not from its core masonry, this sample produced yet another strikingly anomalous date, 3450 BC, plus or minus 950 years, when assayed for surface luminescence. Only at the youngest end of the range, 3450 minus 950 equals 2500 BC, does this date approximate to the reign of Menkaure. Although many authorities do not see that pharaoh taking the throne until 2490 BC, and thus after his pyramid was completed, even at the most recent date offered by the surface luminescence spectrum. But what is more disturbing are the other possibilities raised by the dating, in other words, that the facing stones of the so-called Pyramid of Menkaure could have been put in place as early as 3450 BC, or even perhaps 950 years before that, in other words, in 4400 BC, and thus deep in the pre-dynastic period, almost 2000 years prior to the Old Kingdom. More work needs to be done to settle all this. As I've said, I remain willing, for the moment, to accept the still prevailing mainstream view that dates the pyramids to the Old Kingdom. But what is in the process of emerging, I think, is recognition of the need for a more nuanced view of the whole site, with strong indications from geology, from astronomy, and now from surface luminescence dating as well, that it can no longer be attributed exclusively to the epoch of 2500 BC, but rather appears to be the result of a series of developments over an immensely long time frame, going back more than 12,000 years. As Professor Ioannis Liritsis of the University of the Aegean, lead author of the surface luminescence study, concludes, parts of the site appear to have been reused, and it is a reasonable assumption that some of the structures were already present at Giza when the large-scale works of the Fourth Dynasty began. Nor is the question of the age of the site the only open one. Its function, too, is up for grabs. Egyptologists like to define the pyramids as tombs and tombs only. But as Professor Liritsis notes, the lack of contemporary human funerary remains from any Egyptian pyramid, and the obvious astronomical and geometric nature of the site that prove their orientation was not by chance, but in here knowledge and star configuration patterns at the period of construction, imply that the pyramids as tombs theory is no longer sufficient, and a broader determination of age, function, and reuse of both pyramids and Giza is required. This book, which descended from the sky. We've seen that there are many passages in the Edfu building texts which tell us that those amongst the gods of the early primeval age, who survived the flood that destroyed their former homeland, set about wandering the world with the purpose of establishing new sacred domains in suitable locations. One passage names a specific location that some of these gods found their way to, the first place they settled in Egypt. This turns out not to have been Edfu in upper, southern Egypt, but rather the city that the Greeks later came to know as Heracleopolis, which is located in lower, northern Egypt, and which the Egyptians themselves named Henen Nesut, meaning the house of the royal child. Archaeologists do not know where Henen Nesut was established, but a reference to it on the Palermo stone so called because it is now kept in the archaeological museum of the city of Palermo in Italy, sheds some light on the matter. An ancient fragment of inscribed diorite, the Palermo stone, provides information, dismissed as mythological by Egyptologists, of some 120 pre-dynastic kings said to have ruled in Egypt prior to 3000 BC. But it also gives details of the early dynastic period, which Egyptologists accept as historical. An entry on the stone, dating to the reign of Den, the second king of the first dynasty, suggests strongly that the origins of Heracleopolis Henin-Nesut go very far back into the pre-dynastic period. But Henin-Nesut is just where the trail begins, because it turns out it was closely associated with the ancient religious center of Memphis, Inbuhej, later Menifer, which stands about 60 miles, 100 kilometers further north, and was, according to legend, established by Menes, the first king of the first dynasty, although again its origins are likely to be far earlier. It is therefore of interest, as Eve Raymond, the translator of the Edfu building texts, observes, that it is impossible to read the principal Edfu records and not be struck by the very pronounced Memphite background and tone that is still preserved in them. In her view, the Edfu texts preserve the memory of a pre-dynastic religious center which once existed near Memphis, a center which the Egyptians looked on as the homeland of the Egyptian temple. Note she is not saying which once existed in Henin-Nesut, nor even in Memphis itself, but rather near Memphis. In short, the location is a bit of a mystery. Raymond supposes that archaeology has not yet identified it. But wherever it was believed to be a place carefully selected by the gods for the foundation of the first of the new generation of temples dedicated to the god Horus, the essential opening gambit in the long-term project to recreate the destroyed former world. A text on the inner face of the enclosure wall at Edfu was recognized as an important clue by Raymond in her own search for the mystery location, since it tells us that the primordial temple of Horus was built at the dictates of the ancestors, according to what was written in this book, which descended from the sky to the north of Memphis. An extensive burial ground for the ancient kings of Memphis, known to Egyptologists as the Memphite Necropolis, rose to particular prominence during the Fourth Dynasty, 2613 BC to 2492 BC, when, according to Orthodox chronology, both the Great Pyramid and the Great Sphinx are supposed to have been built. The pyramid fields of Dahshur, Saqqara, and Giza were all integral parts of the necropolis, so in theory, all might be candidates. But at Giza, as we've seen, the Sphinx models the constellation of Leo in 10,500 BC. The three pyramids model the belt of Orion in the same epoch, and the four shafts of the Great Pyramid lock on to specific stars in the later epoch of 2,500 BC. Far more obviously than Dahshur and Saqqara, therefore, it seems to me that Giza absolutely merits description as a book which descended from the sky, a book written with the pen of megalithic architecture in the script of precession. There is something else. The god Horus, for whom the primordial temple was built, is a complex figure who manifests in many different symbolic forms, notably the falcon. Indeed, an imposing granite statue of Horus the Falcon stands in the forecourt at the Temple of Edfu to this day. Horus was likewise frequently depicted as a man with the head of a falcon, a classic therianthrope, in other words, like the Apkallu sages of Mesopotamia. But Horus had another prominent avatar, and that was as a lion. Moreover, this Horus lion was sometimes depicted as a therianthrope, with a human head. And there is a specific inscription in the Edfu temple which tells us that Horus of Edfu transformed himself into a lion which had the face of a man. Mystery of the Sphinx. Given the connection that the Edfu texts draw with the Giza area and with that mysterious book descended from the sky, It is therefore impossible to ignore the fact that the ancient Egyptians closely identified Horus with the Great Sphinx of Giza. In this capacity, the lion-bodied and probably once lion-headed sphinx was known both as Horemachet, Horus in the horizon, and also as Horakhti, which with a subtle difference of emphasis means Horus of the horizon. However, there's a very odd thing about the Sphinx. With the exception of Dr. Rainer Stadelmann, who believes that it was the work of the 4th dynasty pharaoh Khufu, all other modern Egyptologists are united in the opinion that the Sphinx was made by Khufu's son Khafre. I use the word opinion deliberately, because it's important to be clear at the outset that we are not dealing here with an established empirical fact about the Sphinx, but rather with a received body of Egyptological conjecture, which has gradually, through lack of opposition, begun to be treated as though it were a proven fact. As very often in our discipline, old and seemingly certain statements rest forever without further verification, comments Dr. Stadelmann, who should know what he's talking about since he was director of the German Archaeological Institute in Cairo from 1989 to 1998. When we confine ourselves to the facts about the Sphinx rather than the opinions of Egyptologists, the first thing we discover is that no inscriptions have survived from the Old Kingdom which refer to this stupendous and imposing monument. Even the great Egyptologist Salim Hassan, who conducted extensive excavations at Giza in the 1930s, was therefore obliged to admit, as to the exact age of the Sphinx and to whom we should attribute its erection, no definite facts are known, and we have not one single contemporary inscription to enlighten us on this point. Neither, for that matter, are there any inscriptions from the First Intermediate Period, or from the Middle Kingdom, or from the Second Intermediate Period. Indeed, it is not until we come to the New Kingdom, roughly 1550 BC onwards, supposedly about 1,000 years after it was carved out of the bedrock of the Giza Plateau, that the pharaohs of ancient Egypt suddenly start talking about the Sphinx. What Salim Hassan rightly describes as the earliest authentic opinion is given by Amenhotep II, 1427 to 1401 BC, who built a small temple that can still be seen today on the north side of the Sphinx enclosure. There, on a limestone stela, this New Kingdom pharaoh refers to the Sphinx under the names Horemachet and Horakhti, and also makes a direct reference to the Giza pyramids, which, to the annoyance of Egyptologists, he does not ascribe to his 4th dynasty predecessors Khufu, Khafre, and Menkaure, but rather nominates as the pyramids of Horemachet. The clear implication is that in Amenhotep's time, far closer to the 4th dynasty than our own, there existed no historical archives, nor even any tradition that linked the pyramids with the three pharaohs whom modern Egyptologists now insist were their builders. On the contrary, as Salim Hassan explains, the use of the epithet Pyramids of Horemachet suggests, since Horemachet was one of the names by which the Sphinx was known, that Amenhotep considered the Sphinx to be older than the pyramids. Chronologically, the next inscription referring to the Sphinx occurs on the famous Dream Stela of Thutmosis IV. The story goes that before he ascended to the throne, the future pharaoh was out hunting one day around Giza, where the Sphinx lay forgotten, buried up to its neck in sand. Thutmosis took a siesta in the shade of the giant head, at which point a vision of sleep seized him at the hour when the sun was in the zenith. And he found the majesty of this revered god, speaking with his own mouth, as a father speaks with his son, saying, "Behold thou me, see thou me, my son Thutmosis, I am Horemachet, who will give thee my kingdom on earth." However, there was a condition, for the Sphinx said, "The sand of this desert upon which I am has reached me. My manner is as if I were ailing in my limbs. Thou shalt be to me a protector." To cut a long story short, Thutmosis understood that if he were to clear the Sphinx of sand and restore it to its former glory, he would become pharaoh. Accordingly, he did as he was instructed, and when the restoration was complete, and the throne was his, as prophesied, he erected the Dream Stela in commemoration. If you visit the site today, you can still see the huge stela. It's nearly 12 feet high and more than 7 feet wide, standing between the paws of the Sphinx, directly in front of the monument's chest. But much of the original inscription from the 13th line onwards has flaked away. In the 1830s, however, a cast was taken of it, at which time some, though unfortunately not all, of the 13th line was still intact. There the single syllable kaf, no longer present today, was noted, and from this, as the American Egyptologist James Henry Breasted comments in his authoritative translation of the stela, many have been inclined to conclude that the Sphinx was the work of Khafre. Such a conclusion, Breasted adds dryly, does not follow. He points out that there is in fact no trace of a cartouche, the oval sign that normally enclosed royal names, on the copies and casts of the stela that were made in the 19th century, which suggests strongly that the syllable kaf did not refer at all to the 4th dynasty pharaoh Khafre. Moreover, as Selim Hassan later added, even if the cartouche had been there, we are not at liberty to conclude from the damaged line that Khafre made the Sphinx. At the most, it would tell us that Thutmosis in some way connected the Sphinx with Khafre. Even Gaston Maspero, who was the director of the Department of Antiquities at the Cairo Museum in the late 19th century, and who did believe the cartouche had once been present, saw no reason to deduce from such flimsy evidence that the Sphinx was Khafre's work. On the contrary, his preferred interpretation was that the purpose of Thutmosis in this part of his inscription was to recognize a former renovation and clearance of the Sphinx undertaken by Khafre. Consequently, Maspero wrote, we have here almost certain proof that the Sphinx was already buried in sand in the time of Khufu, Khafre's father, and his predecessors. Maspero would later change his view, grudgingly stating that the Sphinx probably represents Khafre himself, and thus falling in line with the growing consensus amongst Egyptologists of the 20th century. His initial opinion that the monument was older than Khafre, and indeed had been buried in sand in the time of Khufu, had in part been based on information contained in yet another stela, the so-called inventory stela, discovered at Giza in the 1850s by the French archaeologist Auguste Mariette. The gist of the inventory stela, once also referred to as the stela of Khufu's daughter, was that the Great Sphinx and the Wali Temple, as well as a number of other structures on the plateau, were already in existence long before Khufu came to the throne. What apparently debunked it, however, and no doubt contributed to Maspero's change of mind, was firm evidence that the hieroglyphic writing system used in the inscription was not consistent with the style of the 4th dynasty, but belonged to a much more recent period, Selim Hassan suggests the 26th dynasty. This interesting little stela has therefore subsequently come to be regarded as a work of fiction, most likely fabricated by a group of priests who wished to magnify the name of the goddess Isis, who was popular in the 26th dynasty, 664 to 525 BC, and thus of no value in our attempts to determine what happened at Giza nearly 2,000 years earlier in the 4th dynasty, or perhaps long before. That is certainly how things look when viewed through the prism of Egyptologic, in other words, that special form of reasoning with a built-in double standard deployed only by Egyptologists. According to Egyptologic, if evidence supports established theories, then that evidence will be accepted. But if evidence undermines established theories, then that evidence must be rejected. Thus, Egyptology uses entirely circumstantial and non-contemporary data to support its present claim that the Sphinx and its megalithic temples were the work of the pharaoh Khafre of the 4th dynasty. As we've seen, Selim Hassan admits that we have not one single contemporary inscription to enlighten us as to the exact age of the Sphinx. So the dating of the monument to the Fourth Dynasty, something that Egyptologists tout as fact, that is taught as such in universities, and that is widely disseminated by the media, rests entirely on its context, the nearby pyramid.